University of Utah professor of political science Jim Curry says these days pretty much everyone hates Congress.
If you ask people to describe Congress, they'll call it broken, dysfunctional, gridlocked, corrupt, bought, lazy, stupid, and many other unpleasant things. But more importantly, people describe Congress and its actions as perplexing. When people read about Congress and hear about what's happening on Capitol Hill, the typical response is for them to scratch their heads and ask, why does Congress do things that way? Why do they fight so much? Why can't they get anything done?
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, an assemblage of political science academics from across the country discuss how Congress really works. That's coming up. But first, here's this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. For those most frustrated by the ostensible dysfunction of the U.S. Congress, the only solution is to throw all the bums out. But to a large degree, public dissatisfaction stems from a lack of understanding of how Congress works. But for those looking to make change, understanding the system is crucial. Those who want to get involved should know what they're getting involved in. And for people to cast informed votes, they must understand the system to which they are electing representatives. Today on this program, political science professors from across the country gathered to talk about how Congress really works, to help us understand the systems and mechanics of Congress beyond the personalities elected to it. The purpose of today's discussion is also to show that Congress is more than the conflict-ridden place that's often presented in the media. This forum was recorded on March 27, 2015, and here to introduce the panelists, who are four of the top scholars of congressional politics in the country, is Professor Jim Curry. He's a professor of political science at the University of Utah, and he will be the moderator.
Immediately to my left is Greg Koger, associate professor of political science at the University of Miami, where he researches legislative politics and public policy. He's the author of numerous publications on parties, lobbying, and Congress, including the award-winning book, Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate. And prior to his academic career, Greg also worked as a legislative assistant on Capitol Hill. To his left, Catherine Pearson is associate professor of political science at the University of Minnesota, where her research focuses on the U.S. Congress, congressional elections, political parties, women in politics, and public opinion. She's the author of several articles and book chapters, as well as her forthcoming book, Party Discipline in the House of Representatives. And prior to her academic career, she also served on Capitol Hill as a staffer. Laurel Harbridge is assistant professor of political science at Northwestern University, where her research focuses on partisan conflict and the lack of bipartisan agreement in American politics. She has published several articles on this topic, and as well as her brand new book, Is Bipartisanship Dead? Policy Agreement and Agenda Setting in the House of Representatives. And finally, at the far end, John Wilkerson is professor of political science at the University of Washington, where his research centers on legislative organization and decision making, with related interests in health politics and comparative legislative studies. He's authored dozens of books, articles, and edited volumes, including his recent book, Congress and the Politics of Problem Solving, co-authored with Scott Adler. Each of these scholars will provide brief comments on our topic today, and subsequently as a group, we will discuss some important questions about Congress. So with that, I turn the mic over to Greg.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Let's start with a little bit of biography. So about 20 years ago, I graduated from Willamette University with a bachelor's degree in political science and a vague desire to go to graduate school at some point and no short-term plan. So I floated to Washington, D.C. and was very lucky to get hired as a legislative assistant for a member of Congress from Eastern Washington State. Fine. And I was excited because, you know, I was interested in public policy. This is my chance to make the world a better place in a very small way. And what I gradually learned and then came to accept was that that wasn't really my job. That the congressman that I worked for was interested in getting reelected, and that a large part of the process of getting elected is, you know, to think carefully about what positions you want to take, what you're going to say about various issues, which bills you want to express support for, what votes you're going to cast. And that was it. So my work as a scholar starts with that as a somewhat cynical starting point. The legislators are interested in getting reelected and keeping their jobs, like the rest of us, and that they care a lot about what they say and what positions they take, but not necessarily what gets accomplished by Congress. And that creates a puzzle for Congress, right? That by itself is not a new opinion, right? So one of the most classic books in congressional scholarship is David Mayhew's Congress Electoral Connection, which starts with the exact same point. Members just want to get elected, and part of that is taking positions. And then in Mayhew's story, that means the legislators set up a Congress that just helps them get reelected in a straightforward way. I start at the same place, but for me what's fascinating is how, as individuals, legislators are thinking about themselves, but collectively what Congress does isn't that bad. And so the puzzle is to figure out how people who are thinking only about themselves nonetheless can do a reasonably good job of governing collectively. And so I'm interested in, I have been interested in three areas of study. And basically, if you categorize legislation in two ways, one is whether it's popular or not, whether a majority of the members of Congress want to vote for it, and whether or not it's good policy, whether it's actually going to make the country a better place. Then you can have bills that are popular and good policy, that's easy. Unpopular and bad policy, also easy. But the really tricky ones are the pieces of legislation that are popular but really bad policy, right? So you have a bunch of legislators who want to vote for something, who tell people that they like it, but they know in their hearts probably, at least at the margins, that they're really bad ideas. So how do they set up a process where they can express support for really bad ideas, but then also make sure that they don't get passed? On the other end of the spectrum is things that have to be done but aren't popular. How does Congress manage to pass legislation or act on policy areas where it's costly for them, it hurts their electoral chances, to enact policies that they know they have to do? And for me, then, the three areas of study that I have found most fascinating with this set of interests is, well, one, agenda setting, right? So how do legislators decide which bills to bring up and talk about and debate and pass? Because one easy way to dispose of things that are popular but bad policy is to just never actually bring them to the floor of the House or Senate. So everyone can say, oh, we should really pass that bill. Don't bring it up, right? So agenda setting, right? How do legislators set the agenda? Second is the notion that parties are bring in some degree of collective responsibility. So as an individual legislator, a member of Congress might not care that much about whether a bill passes or not. But as a member of a party, the legislator knows that the party will be held responsible for what they accomplish or what they don't accomplish. And that if they do something great, that they will get credit for that for years to come. And so the parties bring in some degree of responsibility for making good public policy. And then third, which was the subject of my first book, is how legislators can set up veto points in the legislative process so that things that are popular but bad policy can die along the way. So one of the things that brought me to filibustering as a topic is that is the notion that at the core, legislators can come up with rules by simple majority vote. And so to say, oh, I can't believe that the minority kept us from passing that bill, is in some ways a dodge, right? Because the majority could change the rules of the Senate or the House to get rid of filibustering when they want to. And yet, for most of congressional history, legislators have tolerated filibustering because on some level, they like to allow it to persist. And one reason that in my view, they have allowed it to exist is that they like situations in which the majority brings up bills that are popular but maybe bad policy, and then let them die, but let the minority of the legislature take responsibility for it. So that is what I've been working on. Thank you.
And that was Greg Koger, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Miami. He specializes in legislative politics and political parties and is the author of Filibustering, A Political History of Obstruction in the House and Senate, published in 2010. And next, this is Catherine Pearson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. Her research focuses on the United States Congress, congressional elections, political parties, women in politics, and public opinion. She is currently working on a book titled Party Discipline in the House of Representatives.
I want to briefly discuss congressional representation, going back to the framers' conceptions and concerns about representation, revisiting some of their concerns, and thinking more about representation today. In designing the Constitution, the framers were particularly concerned about representation and about tyranny, fearing that Congress would be the most powerful branch. These concerns are reflected and persist in the design and functioning of Congress today. By design, Congress is the branch closest to the people. Originally, the House was designed to represent people, and the Senate was designed to represent states. Since the Senate has been directly elected by the people since 1913 with the passage of the 17th Amendment, both chambers now represent people. But again, the House, with two-year terms, districts on the basis of population, is still supposed to be the closest branch. At the founding, anti-Federalists were concerned that House districts back then were too large at around 30,000 people, and they were concerned about what this meant for the quality of representation. Anti-Federalists thought Congress was too small and should be bigger, because members of Congress should be, and I quote, a true picture of the people, possess the knowledge of their circumstances and wants, sympathize in all of their distresses, and be disposed to seek their true interests. They would be quite surprised to know that the population of today's districts number around 700,000, a far cry from the 30,000 to 40,000 per member that they envisioned. The number of members in the House has been stable since 1910, although, of course, districts keep growing. According to the U.S. Census, the nation is projected to reach the 400 million population mark by around 2039, meaning that House members then will represent, on average, 920,000 people by then, making it increasingly difficult for individual members to connect with their constituents and to know their needs and desires. On the other hand, since the time of the founding, obviously communication has transformed, and members of Congress are much better able to reach their constituents, and constituents are better able to contact their member of Congress, even if going through staff and not in person. Indeed, people who are interested in Congress also have a much greater ability to gather information about Congress, as one of the presentations John Wilkerson's will make clear in a few minutes. So what about the concern over the type of people elected? Is Congress a true picture of the American people? Let's look at the House and Senate demographically today, comparing it to the population. So reference the slide overhead. So women comprise about 19% of the House, 20% of the Senate, and 51% of the American public. These numbers are both high watermarks in the U.S. House and in the U.S. Senate, although a far cry from true descriptive representation. Whites comprise about 62% of the American public, but 80% of the U.S. House and 94% of the U.S. Senate. You can see African Americans, about 10% of the House, 2% of the Senate, 17% of the American public. Hispanics and Latinos, 8% of the House, 3% of the Senate, about 18% of the American public. Asians, 2% of the House, 1% of the Senate, and about 4% of the American public. So along gender lines and along racial and ethnic lines, Congress is clearly not representative of the American public. If you look at the numbers about education, about 61% of the American public has at least an associate's or bachelor's degree or a higher level of education. Compare that to the U.S. Congress. No members of the Senate have lack a college degree, and only 5% of the House don't have a college degree. If you compare the numbers for advanced degrees, the contrast is even starker. What about attorneys? 40% of the House is comprised of attorneys, 60% of the Senate, and less than 0.5% of the American public. I actually couldn't find good data about people who work in business in the American public, but I think it's likely that it is far short of the 53% of the House and 42% of the House Senate with a business background. Now, what about millionaires? In total, the U.S. House and U.S. Senate is comprised of about 58% of millionaires, again, compared to a little bit less than 1% of the American public. So indeed, the House and Senate are not descriptively representative of the American public. But political scientists have theoretical and empirical debates about how much this matters. After all, party identification in today's Congress, rather than any of these demographic factors, is the best predictor of a roll call vote on the House or Senate floor. But a lot of evidence based on empirical, systematic research by political scientists and anecdotal evidence show that women and people of color bring different life experiences and perspectives to Congress that are reflected in legislative activities that occur before the roll call vote process. So political scientists have found that when it comes to bill sponsorship, bill co-sponsorship, amendments offered in committee and on the floor, committee activity, speeches, that there is a strong link between descriptive and substantive representation. Though the success of legislation is largely at the behest of party leaders, and so which party controls Congress heavily shapes representation along descriptive lines as well. Descriptive representation also matters for institutional legitimacy. In particular, people of color are more likely to contact their member of Congress and trust Congress when they are represented by a member of the same race. In a survey of the American people that I conducted with Dara Strolovich, we found that only 28% of the population actually looks first to their member of the House for representation at the national level. Other people were likely to pick the president, party leaders, organized interest in groups for representation. That 28% was a plurality, but nonetheless, we were very surprised that more people didn't actually look at their member of Congress for representation. The framers intended elections to provide that link and responsiveness to members of Congress and their constituents. But today's incumbent re-election rates are very high, averaging over 80% in the Senate and over 90% in the House. In the most recent midterm elections in 2014, 95% of House incumbents who ran for re-election were re-elected, and 82% of senators were re-elected. The number of competitive races is down, and the number of members who represent districts where their party's presidential candidate did not win is the lowest it has been in decades. So cross-pressured members are down. So we might think this link that is so critical between constituents and their members of Congress, this electoral link, is not very strong. But on the other hand, think about the comments that Greg just made and all of the ways in which members of Congress who are so concerned with re-election don't necessarily focus on a trustee model of representation, focused on the general good and the greater good of the whole, and are more inclined to think about short-term decisions in voting in their re-electoral interests. Last night, the Senate debated nearly 50 amendments until after 3 a.m. to pass a budget resolution. But none of those amendments actually matter because they're attached to a non-binding resolution. So this is just the most recent example of the ways in which members of Congress thinking about their electoral interest are voting on policy that literally will not become law because it's attached to a non-binding resolution. Yet both parties have already put out press releases about votes, particularly of vulnerable members. So that electoral link, nonetheless, is still alive and well, but I think it remains to be seen whether or not that's a good thing in today's polarized era.
And that was Catherine Pearson, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. Today, we have four of the nation's top scholars on congressional politics discussing how Congress really works. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, today we're airing a discussion of how Congress really works with some of the best scholars on congressional politics and national policy making. Picking up where we left off, this is Laurel Harbridge, professor of political science at Northwestern University. Her research focuses on partisan conflict and the lack of bipartisan agreement in American politics. She recently published her book, Is Bipartisanship Dead?, that explores how party leaders in the House of Representatives changed from prioritizing legislation with bipartisan agreement in the 1970s to prioritizing legislation with partisan disagreement by the 1990s. This is Laura Harbridge.
So thank you again for the opportunity to be here today, both to Jim and to all of our sponsors of this event. So the perspective that I took on trying to understand how Congress really works is thinking about the extent of partisan conflict that we see in recent years in Congress, and in particular, trying to understand some of the roots of this partisan conflict and why it's so much higher today than it was in past years. So when we think about partisan conflict, the argument that I want to make is that partisan conflict is not simply about a lack of common ground on policy. That instead, it's important to differentiate first whether or not members of Congress are unable to find common ground versus whether there are places of potential common ground and they choose not to pursue those places. So as was alluded to by Greg before, agenda setting matters in Congress. That members introduce lots of bills, but not all of those bills receive further legislative attention. There are lots of steps in the process where party leaders, in particular in the House, are able to kill bills and decide which bills to move forward. And given this opportunity, there may be reasons to think that they're going to be strategically pursuing either places of bipartisan agreement or places of partisan disagreement. And second, along these lines, I think that we need to consider the incentives that leaders face in order to focus on these places of partisan legislation. So thinking about what incentives do they have to pursue bipartisanship where it exists versus what incentives do they have to focus on places of disagreement instead. So my own work has tackled this by looking at patterns of bipartisan agreement in the House of Representatives. And the figure before you here provides two different ways of looking at bipartisanship over time. On the left-hand side are the typical measures that you see. So looking at patterns of roll call voting. So this is the percent of roll call votes that were bipartisan. So here were the majority of Democrats and a majority of Republicans voting together. On the right-hand side is an alternative measure that looks at the bill co-sponsorship coalitions that members form. And these are coalitions that occur on a much broader set of bills before these kind of crucial agenda-setting steps occur. And while the precise measures here of how bipartisanship is defined differ, the key pattern that I want you to see here is that the extent of bipartisan agreement falls much more dramatically in the roll call vote measure, so particularly between the 1973, so the 93rd Congress, and the mid-1990s, than the co-sponsorship measure does. This suggests that this kind of potential for bipartisan agreement, so what we're capturing in the co-sponsorship measure here, declined somewhat over this period, but didn't drop off at all in the same extent that we might see in roll call voting. So to understand this difference, I think that agenda setting is important. So in particular, so this shows again just that measure of co-sponsorship, so this potential for bipartisan agreement, and declines relatively little over time. However, if we add on measures of agenda setting, so looking at of these co-sponsored bills, of the ones that actually receive roll call votes, what percent of those were ones that had bipartisan coalitions? So are leaders pursuing bipartisan agreement or not? And what the kind of thick dotted line that you see there shows is that in the 1970s, party leaders disproportionately pursued places of bipartisan agreement. By the mid-1990s, they were pursuing bipartisanship at much lower rates, rebounded a bit in the late 1990s up until 9/11, and then began to fall off again. So this figure here ends in 2004. I'll come back in a moment to more recent data. So this suggests that we have a difference between this potential for bipartisanship and the extent to which bipartisanship is pursued by party leaders. So why make this shift then? So the first speaks back to these electoral incentives of members. So over this time period of the 1970s through the 2000s, there's been a dramatic shift in the kind of alignment of parties and districts in the House. So in the 1970s, many congressional members represented districts where the partisanship of their voters was not well aligned with the partisanship of their own party. So in particular, we had Democrats who represented Southern conservative districts. By the 1990s and 2000s, you had a greater alignment of these coalitions. So you had fewer members who were cross-pressured between their party and their constituency. So you had a sorting of these congressional districts over time. And this allowed members to support these partisan agendas without fear of electoral consequence in their districts in the same way that they did before. Another reason that you might pursue partisan legislation when you can, so when members' electoral interests are not preventing it, is that there are several different benefits from differentiating the two parties. So first, partisan legislation is going to help you point out the kind of key differences of your party brand. What do you stand for versus what does the other side stand for? It also is going to allow you to take positions that respond to the interest groups that might be supporting you. And we know that these interest groups tend to concentrate on the partisan extremes and not on the partisan center. We also know that primary election concerns may push members to care not just about the general election, where they might be concerned about whether they're cross-pressured or not, but that primary election concerns really might pull them to the flank and lead them to want to pursue partisan legislation rather than bipartisan legislation. We also have a greater competition for majority control in recent years, and this is something we may come back to later as well, that compared to previous eras where the Democrats were the dominant majority in Congress from the 1950s to the 1990s, that in the last decade and a half, we've had much greater competition for majority control. And when you have competition for majority control, pursuing bipartisan legislation may not be such a great option for party leaders. It's going to create coalitions that allow the kind of vulnerable seats that your party's trying to gain in the next election to come out looking favorably as part of this broader bipartisan coalition. So as a Democratic staffer told me, that these competitive districts are the ones that each party thinks that they could take over. So why would the Republicans want to work with them and make them look well? He says, you don't want to make them look well. You want to make them look like they're with Clinton or Obama or whoever, and you want to exterminate them. And the same argument holds for Democrats confronting Republican districts that they want to pick up. Forging bipartisan coalitions provides electoral cover to these members rather than kind of forcing them to take politically unpopular positions. So then we have to think about what's historically constrained partisanship. So what has pushed bipartisan legislation onto the agenda? So here, as I noted before, members' general election concerns have historically kind of forced some of this more bipartisan legislation onto the agenda. Partisanship hurts members in these unsorted districts where they're cross-pressured between party and constituents much more than it does members in sorted districts. And also that the majority party does have an incentive to produce a record of legislative success. We know that partisan conflict tends to damage institutional approval and that the public holds Congress accountable for legislative problem solving, as John Wilkerson's work shows, and that in this case, bipartisan pieces of legislation are often going to be the easier way to produce a record of legislative success, particularly if you're facing divided government or small majorities when partisan legislation may not pass. So I want to turn then to just briefly saying what's happened to bipartisanship since 2008, so kind of since the election of President Obama. So I want to begin by just laying out where we were before. So the dots lay out the kind of this potential for bipartisanship, this co-sponsorship measure. And the line shows the trajectory of what's happened to bipartisanship over time. So it's declined a bit, not a whole lot. And the line kind of continues on into the future there of kind of projecting what bipartisanship would look like if it declined at a similar rate to the past. The black dots show what it actually looks like. And what you can see is that the last two Congresses there, so the 111th and the 112th, so those represent the 2009-2010 and the 2011-2012 Congresses, that bipartisanship dropped 10 percentage points relative to just 4 years before and to levels that had not been seen in the previous four decades. So the potential for bipartisan agreement did decline much more dramatically since the election of President Obama than it did previously. And this decline in bipartisanship is magnified even further by this decline in bipartisan agenda setting. So again, using these measures of looking at of these co-sponsored bills that actually do receive roll call votes, so they get onto this next stage of the agenda, what percent had bipartisan agreement, we can see that, again, in these more recent Congresses, we're at levels of bipartisanship and the agenda setting side that are on par with the 104th Congress back in the mid-1990s as kind of the low point of pursuing bipartisan agreement. So I think there are three important lessons that come out of this for understanding how Congress works. The first is that even when there is common ground between the parties, leaders may not choose to pursue these bills on the House floor. Second, that the potential for bipartisan agreement declined relatively little between 1973 and 2004, but then dropped dramatically after 2008. And finally, that declining bipartisanship in these co-sponsorship coalitions is then magnified by how the leaders structure the agenda and what actually receives a vote. So they may disproportionately pursue bipartisan legislation at some points in time, but in the current period, they may disproportionately pursue places of partisan disagreement as well.
And that was Laura Harbridge, professor of political science at Northwestern University. Next, this is John Wilkerson, professor of political science at the University of Washington. His research has centered on legislative organization and decision-making with related interest in health politics and comparative legislative studies. He has authored dozens of articles and books, including Congress and the Art of Problem Solving, co-authored with Scott Adler.
I was supposed to end on a happy note, so here we go. I wanted to actually sort of move from the abstract, broader patterns of policymaking in Congress to actually talk about a specific example of policymaking to finish things off. And then the last thing I wanted to do was show you an application that we've developed that you can use to actually find out more about what Congress is actually up to today and what your members of Congress are doing as well. So the issue that I wanted to talk about was nursing home regulation in the United States. And this is an issue that's been on the agenda for a long time. And it's an important issue because it's expensive. So we spend about $150 billion per year as a society on nursing home care, caring for about 1.5 million Americans. The federal government spends about $90 billion of that amount every year. So this is an important investment by the federal government, and Congress has incentives, and the American public has incentives to pay attention to how these programs are working or not working, right? And so what I'd like to do is sort of tell you about how Congress has addressed this problem over time and sort of give you a linear story about what happens, right, at the institutional level in terms of the policymaking process. And I'm going to start in the most recent events and move backwards. So I don't know how many of you know this, but the Affordable Care Act of 2009, aka Obamacare, includes a bunch of provisions that really have nothing to do with providing health insurance to people who don't currently have it, right? The Affordable Care Act is actually 903 pages long, and includes lots of stuff in it. And one of the things it includes is Title VI, Subtitle B, the Nursing Home Transparency and Improvement Act, right? And so here's a law contained within a larger omnibus law that seeks to address problems in the nursing home care system in the United States. And you can see this is just the outline of the provisions of the law, but it's pretty extensive. It's really trying to do something important to address problems that I've identified. So how many of you knew this was in the Affordable Care Act? Okay, one person, great. Most of us don't, right? Most of us don't know what's in the Affordable Care Act at all, right? But there's a lot of stuff that's in the Affordable Care Act that's addressing problems in society that we're failing to give members of Congress credit for. And so I just want to talk about one of them. So where did that provision in the Affordable Care Act come from? Well, it turns out that there was a bill introduced during the same Congress by a Republican senator called the Nursing Home Transparency and Improvement Act of 2009. The provisions in the Affordable Care Act are virtually identical to the provisions in this Republican bill, okay? That's kind of interesting, right? So you have a provision of this bill that no Republican voted for, right? That is essentially a proposal by a Republican member of the Senate. Okay, and if you look at, this is from a resource that's available called GovTrack that can give you history of legislation. One of the things you'll see is this is S-647, the bill in the 111th Congress, and you'll see that it says status died in a previous Congress. This is not the first time that Charles Grassley has introduced this bill. He's introduced similar legislation in previous years, right? And it's only in the 111th Congress that he actually gets traction on this. And he gets traction on it by having it incorporated into a Democratic bill. Okay? So what is Charles Grassley doing related to why is he involved or interested in nursing home transparency? It turns out that in the Senate Finance Committee, he's been working for a long time with the Democratic Senator Herb Kohl to address this problem, right? And so they issued a press release in 2008. The bill itself was passed, and the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2009. In 2008, they have a press release which says, improving nursing home care requires constant vigilance, right? Some problems keep coming up. They need to be fixed so nursing home quality continues to improve and stay improved. More transparency, enforcement, and staff training are all needed. That's what our bill addresses. So you have senators from both sides of the aisle working on this issue. Where did they get interested in this issue? It turns out both of them formerly chaired the Special Committee on Aging, right, which one of its responsibilities in the Senate was to conduct oversight over existing laws relating to nursing home care. Right? And this was a committee that was created in 1977. And so if we step a little further back, part of the reason they got interested in passing the reform was the General Accounting Office, which is an independent agency that oversees federal programs and that sort of thing, issued a report in 1986 saying there are a bunch of problems with the nursing home care system, right? And so here you have Congress responding to problems identified by other federal agencies, right, and moving forward. But the history goes even further back, because where did this report come from? It came from a law that Congress passed in 1987, the Nursing Home Reform Act, which instituted a number of reforms, including requiring resident services, providing a resident's bill of rights, having a survey and certification process for nursing homes that didn't exist before, and also asking for evaluations of the extent to which these reforms were working, right? So that led to the GAO reports, which led to the Special Committee on Aging developing legislation to address the problems identified in the GAO report, et cetera. Okay, we're almost done. Okay. So where did the 1987 OBRA law come from? Well, it came from a report that was issued by the Institutes of Medicine, essentially a bipartisan, highly technical group that essentially looked into the nursing home system and said, how is this system working, right? Why did the Institute of Medicine get interested in this? Well, it turns out they got interested in it because of President Reagan. When President Reagan came in 1981, his Secretary of Health and Human Services said, we start with the assumption that government programs are overregulated and it's up to the interests involved to demonstrate that those regulations need to be maintained, right? So we take a law that's in the Affordable Care Act and we can trace the origins of that law, the reforms that are contained in that law, all the way back to 81, where Reagan is saying, show us that regulations relating to nursing home care matter and that they work, right? And so that emphasis led to the IOM report, and the IOM report said, actually, they're not working very well at all. There are lots of serious problems that we weren't aware of, and that led to this chain of events. Okay, so I know that's complicated, but the fact of the matter is when you're talking about a $150 billion program, right, it's complicated. That's just the way it is, and that's why we have Congress, right? We have an institution where we elect people who are expected to know more than we are to make decisions on our behalf, right? That's a representative government. So in summary, how does Congress work? On my happy side or my positive side, I would say it tries to identify problems in society. It tries to improve the situation, and then it follows up by evaluating whether the solutions that it's developed are working. And then it updates the policy based on what it's learned from that. And this is what's happening behind the scenes in Congress every day. And it's not something that we see in the media because this is not interesting. It's complicated, right? It's not sexy. Conflict is sexy, right? And so there's, I wouldn't want to go overboard and say Congress is always doing the right thing, but I don't think we give Congress enough credit for the work that it does.
That was John Wilkerson, professor of political science at the University of Washington. Now, something that you can't see on radio, but you can check out online, is a project John Wilkerson has been developing called Legislative Explorer. It shows you a pretty cool and easily understandable visualization of the trends of bipartisan bills that have been introduced and passed over the past several decades. It attempts to increase transparency of how Congress is working or not working together. And you can find a link to that on our program's website on kcpw.org. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just tuning in, a few weeks back, a group of political science professors from across the country gathered to discuss how Congress really works. Professor Jim Curry, a University of Utah professor in the Department of Political Science, served as the moderator, and he threw out a few questions for the panelists to mull over.
The first question that we came up with is, so there's a lot of talk every day about how Congress doesn't do its job, but what exactly is Congress supposed to do, and what exactly is its job?
One of the roles that Congress plays is to problem solve and pass laws, and so we can think of that as kind of being the collective goal of Congress, or the collective job of Congress. But I think one of the tensions that we face when we think about Congress's job is that for each individual member, that's not necessarily their job. So we can think about Congress as kind of two different Congresses. One Congress is a kind of lawmaking body in this collective entity. The other is 435 representatives and 100 senators who are each driven by their own electoral interests and are each trying to, you know, even if we think of it as a less selfish way, but kind of a, you know, they're trying to look out for the interests of their constituents. And that if they're following what their constituents want, that may not necessarily align with producing this collective body of work that problem solves. And so I think there's an important tension that we need to understand between those two different jobs that our congressmen play.
One of the things that Congress is supposed to do annually, every year, is to pass the 12 appropriations bills that fund the federal government. These appropriations bills comprise a little bit less than a third of all federal spending. Other federal spending, whether it's entitlements or sort of other statutes, is essentially on autopilot until Congress changes it. But every year, Congress must pass 12 appropriations bills and have the president sign them into law in order to fund federal agencies and, accordingly, federal programs. And we can really see the effects of partisan polarization and a breakdown in the process when we look at what has happened with the annual appropriations process. Only four times since 1977 has Congress not needed to pass a continuing resolution because they've been unable to agree on all of the annual appropriations bills by the October 1st deadline. We saw this year when Congress passed a continuing resolution and an omnibus continuing resolution. Another thing that Congress does with these appropriations bills is they put them all in one package because they can't get agreement with the Congress, with both branches and the president, to pass these bills individually. Another thing that happens with the appropriations process is even though, according to House and Senate rules, these bills are simply supposed to provide funding for the programs that other committees determine, increasingly policy writers are added to appropriations bills, particularly under circumstances of divided government, to force the president's hand to sign policies into law that he would not otherwise if they were freestanding bills. So Congress is supposed to pass 12 annual appropriations bills by October 1. It rarely does that. In 1995 and 96 and in 2011, the lack of Congress doing that actually caused government shutdowns, but most years it simply means a continuing resolution, which is a missed opportunity for policy change. It causes uncertainty in federal agencies that are trying to plan. It doesn't allow Congress to fulfill its role in our separation of powers system and check the executive branch, and causes a lot of uncertainty and then a lot of time in Congress as well when they can't agree on the funding bills.
And fourth, one of the things that Congress should be doing is monitoring and checking the executive branch. One mechanism for doing that is by screening who gets chosen to head the executive branches through the nominations process. For about the last 20 years, the Senate did a lot of this by basically allowing each senator to filibuster nominees, not just because they didn't like them, but because they wanted to have some concern addressed. And in the last 3 years, they've basically taken that power away from themselves, which is a good thing, but then they need to find some other mechanism for doing it, one of which is appropriations bills. If the appropriations process is working well, what Congress can do is put little provisions in the bill that direct agencies or correct them if they need to. And then obviously hearings and investigations, not just on the hot button issues that members of Congress want to use to embarrass the other party, but just generally like checking to see what major problems exist in society that need to be addressed and what
checking each agency to make sure that it is doing what it ought to be doing, and passing follow-up legislation.
Another thing I just want to add in that Congress does that's part of its job is if you look at alleged legislation, Congress commissions a lot of studies, a lot of blue ribbon panels, a lot of, we'll tell the GAO to study this, we'll tell the NSF to study that. And that information can sometimes be useful. And as John showed a great example where it does get used. And then there's also instances where the report comes out and both sides grumble and say, okay, this isn't what we wanted, toss it aside. But it is another job that it does. So that brings up a second related question. As Congress does all these jobs, who exactly does it represent? And whose interests are reflected in the public or elsewhere in the behavior of members of Congress or Congress as a whole as it does it?
All right, one of the things I found as a staffer is that people who donate money get represented in this process a great deal more than the average citizen. In my own experience and in some studies, they have a much higher chance of getting access to staffers and to members of Congress. Members of Congress spend a lot of time fundraising. So, you know, we don't have data on this, but anywhere from 2 to 4 hours a day on average is actually spent just fundraising for the next campaign. So that's just time they're not spending legislating, and it's time that they're spending talking to a relatively small number of people who have money to donate to campaigns. So it's a very stilted conversation. And it's also people who have very strong views on politics, right? So if you are yourself a staunch Republican or a staunch Democrat, and you spend your day talking to other staunch members of your own party, it sort of reinforces your partisanship.
To pick up on what Greg has been saying, Congress definitely does a better job of representing organized interests. While all members of Congress want to represent their constituents, thinking about re-election in ways that they can do that, members of Congress and their staff are likely to take the meetings that come to them with organized interests. So if a lobbying association has a lobby day on Capitol Hill where a member's constituents come out, sort of learn what they're supposed to be telling the member of Congress about, and then they fan out over Capitol Hill to 535 offices, organized interests are more likely to be heard, particularly if an organized interest has a message, you know, please co-sponsor this particular bill that's already been introduced, or when it comes before your committee, we'll be watching you. Please keep that in mind. That said, there's a correlation between organized interest and the money that they perhaps contribute to members of Congress. It's not always a strong connection. So there can be organized interest of underrepresented groups that don't necessarily have the money, but they can make the case that they represent an active part of a member's constituency. I think about this I worked for two different congresswomen, and they were both always interested in meeting with women's groups, particularly constituents, who came to Washington and talked to them about legislation that was important to them.
I think also when we think about who gets represented, it's important to think about when members are representing their constituents, so even on kind of this view that members are looking out for their own electoral interests and therefore considering the views of their constituents, to think about whether they're really concerned with the interest of all of their constituents or whether they're concerned with kind of their co-partisan base. And one of the things that I think has happened as part of this kind of sorting of congressional districts, fewer cross-pressured members, is that more and more members are able to focus on their partisan base and represent their partisan base and not necessarily their broader congressional district. And one of the ways that we can see this kind of mattering is, so some of the work I've done with kind of some public opinion stuff is, again, looking at public preferences for bipartisanship. So one of the things I found is that a majority of people in the public, doesn't matter if they were, you know, Democrats, Republicans, independents, strong partisans, weak partisans, everybody wants Congress as a whole to be bipartisan. But when you're actually looking at people's individual members of Congress, strong partisans actually significantly favor partisanship from their member rather than bipartisanship. Weak partisans and independents prefer bipartisanship. But if we think about members of Congress as having the electoral interests and kind of being responsive to these strong partisans who may also be the donors, might also be more active, then we can see why they might be acting in some of the ways that we see, even though that's not necessarily congruent with what people want from this broader congressional environment.
I guess the one thing I would add is when we talk about special interests a lot as if we all know, you know, who they are. They're those evil people over there, right, that don't have our interests at heart. But if you think about the budget drivers, of the federal government, right? The budget drivers are, for example, healthcare, right, for the elderly. And that is an interest group. It's the largest interest group in America, right? The American Association for Retired People. So AARP plays a really important role in policy. Members from across the political aisles, right, have incentives to be responsive to that interest group. And so I think it's really important to think about, you know, and to recognize that often, right, that members, you know, there are important issues where partisanship doesn't necessarily come into play, right? And that's a problem because both Republicans and Democrats recognize that reform of the healthcare system is necessary, but especially these particular cost drivers, but both sides are reluctant to be the one that takes the lead because of, you know, how that can be played up politically.
So then, to sort of tie this back together, this will be our last discussion question before we open it up for Q&A. As Congress tries to do these jobs and as it does this representational work, or it represents maybe some and not others, why is it that there's so much conflict? And if I can indulge you all to add one thing to that, should we view this conflict as purely bad, or are there positives to take away from the conflict we see on Capitol Hill?
I take the long view. In American political parties, for a long stretch of time, from the 19th century to the early 20th century, a lot of people got involved in politics because they wanted something very specific. They wanted a job or they wanted money. And so they were, you know, as long as they had a job or they were getting their payoff, they were fine. And political parties existed to give people stuff. And that had a lot of externalities, right? If you were an astronaut going into space, you want to know the rocket scientists who designed your rocket got their jobs because they're, you know, rocket scientists and not because they're the friends of somebody who knows the president. So we got rid of these sort of payoffs in terms of jobs. And then the vacuum that created was filled by people who really cared about politics. They were issue-oriented activists, people willing to give money just because they care. People willing to work on campaigns just because they're passionate about issues, which in some ways is purer, but it also means that if you're a politician, that you have to appeal to this, to people who have intense views, by saying that you share their intense views. And one of the reasons that Congress doesn't work is it's filled with people who are responding to intense people with intense views. And who also have long time horizons, right? So they'd rather wait, if you're like an intense Republican, you'd rather wait until the Republicans just run the whole government and they can enact really conservative legislation. Better that than to compromise now. Same on the Democratic side, right? Let's just wait until we're on top and then we'll pass our favorite bills and we won't have to deal with the other side. And that's bad because in the interim, those circumstances, those stars don't align very often. And in the interim, this country is poorly governed. And a lot of opportunities for bipartisanship sit on the wayside.
Well, in addition to the strong divide over policy issues between the two parties, they also are experiencing a level of electoral competition since 1994 that has made them increasingly combative, above and beyond what their policy differences might predict. So Democrats controlled the House of Representatives for 40 years until the 1994 election. But really since then, even though party control has only flipped in 2006 and then 2010 in the House, we've been in an era of what a lot of scholars refer to as toss-up politics, where it is conceivable in the next election or perhaps the next that either party could control the Congress. And so parties not only want to pass their preferred policies, but they also really want to make the other party look bad because of this element of electoral competition. And so party leaders reward members for their loyalty, and some of that is based on policy substance, but some of that is actually based on party reputation and making the other party look bad because of this electoral competition.
And just building off of that, as well as the points that I made earlier, I think that when we think about party conflict, we really need to think about the fact that it both occurs because there are kind of ideological differences between Democrats and Republicans, but also that even when there is common ground, that the leaders don't necessarily have the incentives to focus on it. And that may be true both on kind of typically ideological or partisan issues. It may also be true on less ideological issues, the sorts of distributive politics. You know, we saw in the last couple of years that the Farm Bill, something that's traditionally bipartisan, was crafted to become a much more partisan issue because it worked to the advantage of the parties. On the second question about whether this conflict is a bad thing, on the one hand, it's not necessarily a bad thing. So if the parties can come at issues from distinctly different positions and the institutional environment fosters deliberation and figuring out what the best possible policy is, then the conflict can be good because it really forces people to defend their issues and their positions. However, I think the problem right now is that the institutional environment does not foster that deliberation and compromise, that instead it becomes kind of a take it or leave it. You kind of are going to either accept this offer or not. If you're in my party, you should accept it. If you're in the other party, you're going to oppose it.
Yeah, I think that was the combination there was very insightful. I would underscore what Laurel said, which is that, you know, Congress is supposed to be about sharing ideas, and we have lots of different ideas in society right now, and those are being reflected in Congress. But the question is whether the institution itself is equipped to be able to move forward, right, given those differences. And I think there are aspects of what's happening within Congress right now that are damaging to that. Greg mentioned that members of Congress are spending 2 to 4 hours a day fundraising, and that's time that they're not spending together, right? Talking about ideas, right? Conferring, trying to search or to reach compromise, right? And so that's the way Congress used to work. It used to be a fairly insulated institution where members could make decisions, and then later on they would bear the brunt of their decisions in the electoral process. That Congress is a much more transparent institution now, and it makes it much more difficult to navigate between, you know, differences in ideas to resolutions that are mutually accommodating.
Okay, and with that, we can open it up to questions.
Yeah, we'll devote the remainder of our time for questions. Please state your name and a little bit of information about yourself into the microphone and briefly state your question.
Corey Boren. Has the popularity of so-called bad bills increased due to the news media focusing on controversial or sexy issues in order to increase their own viewerships? And is this built a self-reinforcing loop in which, sorry, disregard that last one, and this is forcing our congressmen and our representatives to do that thing where they know it's a bad bill and they're banking on the minority to shoot it down so they can maintain their partisanship allegiances?
All right, so a bad bill being something that is popular but not actually good policy.
Correct.
Is there incentive? Yeah, yes. I mean, so there is a greater incentive now for parties to schedule, to put bills on the agenda that are very strong but wouldn't actually be productive public policy. I respect that there are a lot of Republicans who would like a different health care policy than the Affordable Care Act, but I would like to see what replacement they have for the Affordable Care Act rather than the simple repeal of everything, including these fine regulations of nursing homes.
And I think just on that, too, is one of the things that I think allows parties to pursue these bad bills, as you termed them, is that when they can assume that the bill is not going to go anywhere in the other legislative chamber, it becomes very easy in one chamber to kind of make these positions, and you can kind of appease your base by saying that you're working on it, but you know that it's not really going to go anywhere. You know that it's not going to pass in the Senate, given the ability to filibuster, and that it's not going to go anywhere on the president's desk, and that you don't have the 2/3 to override it.
Congress has always spent a lot of time on symbolic legislation, but now the partisan nature of this has become really exaggerated, both because the media in general love conflict, and then because of the rise of partisan media, cable news shows who know that their viewers are partisans and really interested in this conflict, and that's why they're tuning in, and so that's what they get. Just last night's sort of amendment fest in the Senate, which lasted until 3 a.m, was a perfect example of this. Both parties were offering amendments that were really important to their party base, forcing some vulnerable senators to take tough votes. Again, all on amendments that will go nowhere because they were to amend a resolution with no force of law.
So on a sort of a slightly different angle here. One of the things, I think this is happening, and this actually started in the 1970s, that there were reforms of the legislative process that allowed members to sponsor amendments on the floor that would, and where there would be a recorded vote. So it created incentives for this blame game, right? So to stick things up there and embarrass the other party and then use it against them in the next election. What I think is kind of interesting to think about is how these developments have impacted the people who decide to run for Congress, right? And so how it's not just, you know, the people who are in Congress being exposed to a different environment, but as the environment changes, it changes the membership of Congress, and probably to people who are more likely or more interested in playing those sorts of partisan games, right? And so we've seen over recent years, we've seen lots of prominent members of Congress resigning, and they're resigning because they're complaining that Congress isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing anymore, right? And they're being replaced by people who like this kind of politics. And so I think, you know, over the long term, that's a real concern, right? How do you, if sort of the equilibrium is saying these are the people who are successful, the people who play those sorts of games, how do you ever get back to what I think you want Congress to be doing, which is problem solving?
My name is John Francis, Department of Political Science, and that was a terrific panel. So my question is, observes that in Europe, people represent fewer numbers of people and have much smaller staffs. So to be mildly provocative, would it be useful in our country to double the membership in the House and to reduce the staff by half, thereby creating a more democratic and more demographically representative body?
So I'll take that to start. So if you think that Congress has a hard time passing legislation with 535 total members, it's hard to see how sort of the partisan cues wouldn't be even stronger with a larger number of members. And so some of the problems that currently plague Congress, I don't necessarily see getting better. In terms of going back to the anti-federalist critique, where a larger chamber should better represent the American people, something would have to change with candidate emergence and I don't know that this would change. So if you look at the number of women in Congress, for example, hovering around 19%, when women run for Congress, women win at the same rate as men. So it's not discrimination at the polls, it's the fact that women are less inclined to run. If you look at candidate emergence among people of color, sort of similar type dynamics. And so scholars have studied states with term limits to see if term limits, sort of the automatic open seats, would actually result in a larger number of women and people in color in those legislatures. And the results are pretty discouraging in the sense that term limits has not resulted in more women, in more African Americans, and only a very, very slight uptick in the number of Hispanics. And so in terms of the diversity, I'm not actually encouraged that it would have a lot of impact. And in terms of reducing the number of staff, I think the legislative capacity issues that have been raised would just mean that members of Congress receive less information about problem solving. Now, they'd also receive fewer partisan talking points as well, but I think in terms of the capacity of Congress, it wouldn't be helpful.
And I think just going off of that as well, one of the challenges, I think, with if you create more districts and therefore smaller districts is one of the same kind of root reasons behind this kind of sorting of the congressional districts, fewer cross-pressured members, is the way in which people are geographically clustered, living near like-minded people. So I actually would worry that if you create more districts, you would actually be creating more safely partisan districts and not necessarily competitive districts. Because if you think about large urban areas as well as kind of more rural areas, that those are kind of going to be your traditionally Democratic, your traditionally Republican areas, and that creating more districts, you might have a greater correspondence between kind of the representation of the people in the district and what position their member takes. But I'm not sure it would solve kind of these bigger problems of the deliberating, the legislating, the problem solving, because it would put potentially more people in the extremes and not more people in the middle.
The Federalist Papers are pretty clear on the notion that there is a trade-off between representation and the way that the institution works. So if you double the number of districts, you'd have closer ties to the people, but the House would then become completely unmanageable, or they'd have to delegate all the power to the Speaker of the House. And so all your news stories would be,
you know, the 500-person majority of the House has decided that John, you know, has delegated all his power to Boehner, and then Boehner has decided to do X, and that would be it.
John, if I could respond to the staff-specific portion of your question. If I was to make a reform proposal for Congress, it would be that individual members should have their staff increased multiple times. The big issue for a lot of members of Congress is not being able to get the information they need to sort of make independent decisions. So they become beholden to committee staff, to leadership staff, to sort of provide them with information that's obviously tailored to the committee's interests and the party leadership's interests. So if, regarding staff, probably a better reform would be to just move the ratios more in favor of equity, especially in the House of Representatives.
I'm Katie McDonald. I'm an English major here. So you talked about how these key people who are donating to the campaign funds, they, a lot of times, obviously, the people who are donating are going to have more say, are going to be able to kind of hold more above the head of the people they're donating to when they're actually making policies. So they favor more of the special interest groups than the actual people. Are there ways, or are there rules, I guess, for these campaigns to kind of level the playing field right now, and can they be improved in order to decrease this like lack of representation of the actual people in favor of the interest groups?
Short answer is no and yes. So no, there's no system in place to level the playing field. What Congress did in the 1970s was put a cap, and then amended in 2002, was they put a cap on the maximum size of donation that you can give to a member of Congress, but they never set up any sort of public financing system the way they set up one for presidential elections, because they did not want a public financing system for their own elections. But yes, it would be possible to set up a system which, say, subsidizes campaign contributions in small amounts, or by people who don't make a lot of money, and thereby sort of level the playing field a bit.
But I think one of the challenges that has come along with all the many efforts at campaign finance reform is that the close connections between donating money and free speech concerns, that essentially, you know, there have been ways to limit some of the kind of donations directly to candidates, but that if someone wants to just kind of, you know, obviously with the PACs and other, you know, super PACs and so forth, that if you're making your kind of own supposedly independent message, that if that's a free speech concern, then it's been very hard to kind of balance the goals of our society there in terms of what we would like to see.
Yeah, and when it comes to political action committees specifically, those who don't, or who are most likely to donate to incumbents to gain access to them, political science literature is actually has not found a lot of evidence that these donation affect behavior on the House and Senate floor. In other words, that they don't change members' voting records. Political scientists have found evidence that they change committee behavior, where those members who get money from particular types of industries are more likely to be active on those issues, offering amendments, appearing at committee markups and the like. But as some members of Congress have noted, if you're looking at these policy issues, there is often, though not always, money on both sides of an issue. So it's hard to sort of say that members of Congress are taking money from a particular interest and then going out and doing their bidding in a large-scale way. The rise of independent expenditures that are taking over the campaigns of many of the most competitive races, where members actually have no say on what the message is, I think is quite problematic and closely linked to parties.
Laurel is correct that the Supreme Court's interpretation of the First Amendment is a real constraint on what Congress can do in terms of campaign finance. So if I were writing a law, the first thing I'd do is exempt campaign finance issues from the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction and simply say, look, Congress has control over the time, places, and manner of its own elections. Members of the Supreme Court, we love you, but you are not elected. You have no idea what game we have to play. And we are going to set up the rules for our own game, not just to prevent corruption of like quid pro quo corruption, where I give Catherine money and she votes the way I ask her to, because she'd never do that. No, really, the members of Congress don't do that, really, most of the time. But the real thing is like the systematic inequality, right? That there's a small number of people who donate money in large chunks, and they have a great deal of influence in this game collectively.
And there's one of my own colleagues has been doing some work actually trying to survey the wealthiest 1% of the United States and look at their policy positions and then look at how that translates to the types of policies that are passed, and definitely does find that not only do the ultra-wealthy have fairly different views than the rest of society, but that they do both perceive greater influence in politics and appear to actually have more influence in politics as well.
It's all great. The one thing I would add is that often the goal is not to get a policy passed, but it's to prevent things from happening, right? So a lot of the places where the greatest influence occurs is stuff that we can't see at all, right? A decision by a member of Congress not to do something, right? How do you study that? It's impossible, right? And so that's really the primary source of money in politics, I would suspect.
I'm Dave Folland. I volunteer for an organization, Citizens Climate Lobby. We're an independent grassroots organization, and we're interested in influencing our members of Congress. So I appreciate your highlighting the things that interest them. This question is related. You mentioned money. We talked about organized groups, their political base. And I was just interested, are there any resources, if somebody like myself or our organization wanted to partner with other people or groups that have similar interests, is there a way to kind of find out who or what groups actually do have that influence with members of Congress? You alluded to kind of the difficulty in finding that out, but are there any resources, either online resources or other resources, that someone could go to try to, you know, sort out who's having the influence with members of Congress that we might partner with, for instance?
That's a really tough question. I'm sort of trying to come up with a good answer. I mean, this is a little bit onerous, but you could actually look at campaign finance reports and look to see both at the individual level and then in particular at the group level who contributes to a member of Congress's re-election campaign. I mean, you're not going to get a schedule of their meetings with lobbyists or interest groups, but you could actually go to fec.gov or better yet, Center for Responsive Politics, where it's a little bit easier to digest FEC information and look to see who has been contributing specifically to that member of members of Congress you want to target.
You can also look at the lobbying disclosure reports. So since 1995, groups that donate at least above a certain threshold of money have to report that. And so both the House and Senate have websites for that. The Senate one is an easier one, kind of on interface. And you can look by, you know, issue areas. You could look at like energy and then, you know, subset below that, and you can see who's giving money in each quarter, you know, half year or quarter or whatever, in terms of identifying groups potentially. But it's definitely a challenge. It all still doesn't capture which ones are successful. It just identifies which ones are out there giving money.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would think that you would also want to go, it's an environmental organization. So there should be coalitions, right, mm-hmm. that lobby Congress that are related to the environment. So, and those people are going to have the intelligence you need more than some political scientists will, or even the Center for Responsive Politics, because Center for Responsive Politics is relying on publicly available information, which is based on disclosures, right, which is really limited in terms of what they ask and what kind of information you can get out of them. But you find, you know, the lobbyist for the Sierra Club, and that person is going to know everything you need to know about every member of Congress, and so that would be my suggestion.
Yeah, one other thing you could possibly do is look at what groups are endorsing legislation that's considered and passed in specifically in committees. Committees often post on their websites when a bill is being considered letters from all these groups that endorse legislation. That at least give you an idea who the major players are. The people that the committee at least thought was worthwhile to point out, like, they like it, and that could give you some sort of idea.
Are there other questions?
Hi, my name is Jessica, and I'm a pre-med student at the University of Utah. And I just wanted to ask you about how gerrymandering is kind of a big problem today. Some people say that it is not an effective way to redistrict states, and it seems like politicians are choosing their voters instead of voting voters choose them. So, like, if I just wanted to ask you, what are your opinions about it, and if it's not effective way, what are the other options that could help resolve that could resolve this problem?
So, the Claims about redistricting and gerrymandering are probably one of the most interesting things that politicians themselves think are a really important driver of polarization and partisan conflict, but where political scientists have pretty heavy-handedly disagreed with them. So the evidence from political scientists tends to say that gerrymandering and redistricting is not really what drives polarization. There are two basic reasons for that. One is that we see similar trends of partisan conflict in the Senate, which has no redistricting. The second is that even when we can look at districts that have kind of similar demographic profiles, similar kind of presidential voting patterns, what really matters is whether a Democrat or a Republican holds that district. That when a Democrat holds that district, they vote in a liberal way. When a conservative holds that district, they vote in a Republican way. And so it's not necessarily about moving all of the districts to the extremes. The other thing I would add to it is, going back to this kind of geographic clustering of where people live, that it would actually be very hard to draw districts in a way that created truly competitive electoral environments.
You have to think about the Senate, right? We don't redistrict the Senate, but the Senate has become substantially more polarized. So it's one factor, but probably not the driving factor of what's happening.
Right, and partisan gerrymanders, where parties do try to gain advantage, really can only happen when the governor is of the same party of both chambers of a state legislature. And so at the individual level, that certainly can impact a member of Congress's career. But if it's a partisan gerrymander in a partisan way, but that doesn't drive polarization. But we've seen some independent redistricting plans, whether it's sort of a nonpartisan group in Iowa that draws the lines, Iowa politicians are just as polarized as everyone else, or in California, where a citizens group redrew the lines and actually put a lot of incumbents in the same district. So redistricting can have tremendous effects for incumbents, causing them to lose, but it doesn't drive polarization in the way that the media reports.
And I guess I can add one other thing. One of the things we haven't talked about is voting turnout. And voting turnout has an awful lot to do with what's happening in politics today as well. If you think about Texas, for example, right? If people voted in Texas, Texas would be a Democratic state, right? Texas is a Republican state because Democrats don't vote in Texas. And so if we were, you know, we think about potential reforms and that sort of thing, increasing voter turnout, you know, ideally along with better information about what's happening in politics could lead to a important differences in how politics operates at the national level as well.
Hi, my name is Mohammed Mathis. I'm a marketing major here. And my question is, you guys mentioned a lot about the Congress receiving receiving a lot of fund from organization and companies. The question is there any way, like, as a citizens, we have power, right? We are the one who, we put them there. Is there anything we can do to stop that? Or, you know, or maybe create other ways that they can get the fund?
Turn out and vote, right? It's a known fact that the younger you are, the less likely you are to vote. If you look at the US budget, the primary function of the US government is to take money from people who work and transfer to senior citizens. That's Social Security and Medicare. We could have a system in which government takes money from those who work and transfers it to college students so that college is very inexpensive or even free, and you don't start your working life with a large load of debt. And then it could be easy to buy a house. And life could be different for you if voting turnout was much higher among young voters.
And I would say beyond just voter turnout, members of Congress really do pay attention to their constituent mail. They don't pay attention to members of the general public from outside their district necessarily in the same way that they do lobbyists or organized interests, but they do pay attention to their constituent mail. And so if you and a bunch of your like-minded friends or perhaps people in groups that you belong to write preferably a handwritten letter as opposed to an email. I know that's old-fashioned, but and send mail to your member of Congress, sort of being very clear about, you know, vote against this bill, vote for this bill. That will have an impact.
I would underscore that. It's not just because I think the point that Catherine's making is that they're not getting mail that's representative of the views of the broader population, right? What they're getting is occasional mail, which is demonstrating intensity of concern about something, right? And so if they get a reasonably small amount of mail, that's a signal that there's this group out there that's actually paying attention to what they're doing, right? And it doesn't have to be a lot of people, and it will register, and it will make a significant difference, right? This is part of why the National Rifle Association is so influential, right? It's not the campaign contributions, that's part of it, but they're able to mobilize their members, right, to let members of Congress know that they're watching, right, when a vote comes along. And so students can do the same thing. It's just that students don't tend to do that. They don't seem to be as focused and intense about the issues. They don't seem to sense the common shared interests that members of the National Rifle Association do, for example.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks to our panelists for appearing today, and thanks to everybody for coming.
Thank you today to Laura Harbridge with Northwestern University, John Wilkerson with the University of Washington, Greg Koger with the University of Miami, and Catherine Pearson with the University of Minnesota, and to the moderator, James Curry, Professor James Curry at the University of Utah. This program was made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss, your producer and host. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week.